Hey, howdy, space nerds. Hope you had a wonderful holiday and happy new year. We've got some great conversations coming up this year on the podcast, but we need your support to keep exploring. So consider making a donation to WMFE. That's the station that produces this podcast, by visiting wmfe.org/support. Your gift helps us keep exploring. And thanks. From the studios at WMFE in Orlando, Florida, this is the Space Exploration Podcast that asks the question, are we there yet? Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. George Takei is best known for his role as Sulu, helmsman on the USS Enterprise during the show Star Trek.
Space, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the starship Enterprise. Its five-year mission, to explore strange new worlds, to seek out new life and new civilizations, to boldly go where no man has gone before.
Now, while the show lasted only about three seasons, its legacy lives on, spawning multiple shows and movies within the franchise. Today, Takei is an advocate for equality, space exploration, and science education. And later this month, he's visiting Rollins College in my neck of the woods here in Winter Park, Florida. But before he makes the trip to Florida, George took some time to chat with me about Star Trek, science fiction, and equality in the 23rd century. Well, George Takei, thank you so much for joining us. It's an honor and a pleasure.
Oh, it's a delight for me to be talking with you.
Well, George, when you took on the role as Sulu on Star Trek, did you have any idea what kind of cultural phenomenon that this show would turn into?
I obviously did not, but I knew that it was going to be an exciting show because when I first went in for an interview with Gene Roddenberry, I asked him, what Star Trek, what does this all mean? Tell me something about the show. And he said that it's going to be a science fiction series set in the 23rd century, and it will take place on a vast, huge spaceship. We're going to call it a starship, and it's going to have a crew of over 1,000 people. And the leadership crew, in fact, the whole crew, will be made up of the diversity of this planet Earth, because the Starship Enterprise is supposed to be a metaphor for Starship Earth. And the strength of the starship lies in its diversity. People from different parts of that planet with different histories, different faiths, different races, different perspectives on issues, all coming together and working in concert as a team. And that very concept sounded exciting to me, because at that time, back in the 60s, we were the civil rights movement was at a crisis point. The colored people were working for equality were being assaulted by law enforcement officers with attack dogs and water hoses. At the same time, we had the Vietnam War going on in a far-off small country in Southeast Asia. But that war was tearing the United States apart. People that supported the war passionately and people that opposed the war just as passionately. And at the same time, we had a Cold War going. Half the planet, the Soviet Union, threatening the West, threatening the Soviet Union, mutually threatening each other with mutual nuclear annihilation, the entire planet going through a global warming crisis. And so all that will be treated metaphorically in science fiction form on this show. And I was really excited about that. And I asked him about my character, and he said he will be part of the leadership team. I thought this would be a groundbreaking opportunity for me, personally, as an actor. But also, the entire concept sounded like a revolutionary idea on television at that time, because television wasn't addressing any of the current issues of the time. And so I was really excited about it. But I had a sense that a show like that would probably, at best, be canceled after the second season. So I had no idea what would happen. And here we are now celebrating the 50th anniversary of Star Trek.
That's crazy.
A show that was canceled after the third season.
So for you, it was more than just an acting job. This was a chance for you to become an advocate and kind of put a new face, a face of diversity in front of the American television viewers.
That was the exciting part. But, no, to be perfectly honest, it was a steady job. I mean, you know, I was doing just guest shots on TV and an occasional minor role in feature films. But this meant regular employment, and that was the main attraction that Star Trek had for me at that time.
Well, other than the kind of the humanitarian aspect of the show and the societal look at the world, there was also some really cool sci-fi tech that was on the show. Kind of walk me through, like, did you have to learn about all this technology and were you interested in learning how these certain things worked and how they could be applied to the real world?
That was the other exciting part of it because, again, here, Gene Roddenberry was a responsible science fiction writer. I mean, you know, it's science fiction, so you're supposed to have free rein on your imagination. But he also wanted to root some of the speculative technology of the future in the realistic speculations by the scientists of the time. So we had as our consultants futurists from the RAND Corporation. And so very interestingly, I thought, you know, our communicator, which at that time was an amazing science fiction device that was attached to our hip by magic. It was actually Velcro attached to our hip with no cords attached. And we walked around all over the ship with it. And whenever we wanted to talk to someone, wherever we were, we'd rip off that communicator, flip it open, and start talking. Well, that design really was being considered by the futurist or the technologists of that time. And so when we got the first cell phone, it had that flip-open quality. So it was the RAND Corporation futurists that helped make reasonably clear how that would work. And the thing is, I mean, today, not only do we have a communicator, but we've gone way past what we had on Star Trek with the iPhone. You know, we buy things on it, we pay for things on it, watch movies on it, do all sorts of things on it, not just talk. So we are today, in 2016, living in a science fiction world. Because all the technology we had back in the 60s was astounding, jaw-dropping technology. A good number of those technologies are reality today. And so what Gene Roddenberry contributed, I think, or all Imagineers contribute, I think, is they have that imagination to think of the unthinkable, imagine the unimaginable, and make that seem credible. And then the technicians and the innovators and the inventors, by trial and error, go for that goal and eventually, ultimately, realize that. So I must say, one of the technologies that we had on Star Trek that we still haven't achieved yet is one that I eagerly and devoutly pray for the early development of, and that's the transporter, where you can sparkle and pop out, and a few seconds later, you sparkle at the destination and pop in, and there you are. No more airports, no more delayed flights or canceled flights, no more security check, no more crowds, you know, just sparkle, and you've traveled.
That'd be great for your busy travel schedule, I'm sure, right?
I would profoundly appreciate that.
Now, I mean, you seem like you were fascinated by speaking with these researchers and these technologists. Did you kind of have like this science geeky aspect about yourself before the show, or do you think that and now you're a science geek now because of working on the show.
I think it's because of Star Trek. I did read Ray Bradbury before Star Trek and was fascinated by that, but I don't think I would have characterized myself as a sci-fi fan. But now, having met some of the sci-fi writers like Norm Spinrad or Harlan Ellison, people like that, they're fascinating people, and they do have that kind of wild imagination that can imagine the unimagined, as Gene Roddenberry did. And so I have been, by conversion or maybe evolution, come to be a sci-fi fan.
Now, it's your role as an actor to kind of, you know, sell this technology. Do you think that having the show and using all this new technology made the American people a little more apt to having a cell phone or a communicator attached to their belt? Did it kind of bring these crazy ideas a little more down to earth with what you were doing in the show?
Well, not only did it bring it down to earth, but I think we are evolving into a different breed of humanity. I mean, young people today, you know, the way their fingers just skitter over the alphabet and texting each other. I mean, my hands are now that of the senior generation, and you know, I still pick out that the letters. But young people now use their thumbs like we use words with our vocal cords. It's amazing what they're able to do physically. I mean, just physically. And so by evolution, I think there's a whole different breed of human beings being developed.
Well, George, I'm 30 and I still can't text on my phone, so don't feel too bad.
Well, you are a youngster from my vantage.
Well, thank you.
In four more months, I will reach that other benchmark age of 80.
Wow.
And, I celebrate every birthday. I'm a disciple of my grandmother. She said her hobby is collecting birthdays, and she amassed a handsome collection.
Well, good.
104 birthdays.
Oh, wow.
So I'm hoping that I have her genes coursing through my body, and I'm doing everything to protect it and encourage it. I intend to beat my grandmother.
And I'm sure you've got a slew of fans that are rooting for you to collect quite a few more birthdays. So,
well, I hope they join me in this campaign to live long and prosper.
Excellent. Well, speaking of living long, the Star Trek the series is seeing a resurgence on the silver screen now, and there's a brand new generation of Trekkies being born. What do you make of the new series of movies that are coming out, and what's it like to see a brand new set of people getting involved in the franchise?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct. There is a brand new generation. The original Star Trek fans at Star Trek conventions are now bringing their grandchildren, and they seem to automatically form the Vulcan greeting when you see them. I think it's very exciting. However, we lost Gene Roddenberry in 1991, and what made Star Trek really unique, I think, is starting to evaporate away from Star Trek. It's still a rip-snorting good space opera. I mean, action-adventure, you know. But that additional dimension of using current social, political, and environmental issues metaphorically in science fiction, that additional dimension I don't think exists in the current movies anymore. But I'm hopeful with the new TV series that's going to get started. It was supposed to start this spring, but now it's been pushed back to next fall. Star Trek Discovery. Brian Fuller, who was, and he's left the show now, but he was the brain trust of the new TV series, and he was a disciple of Gene Roddenberry, and he's incorporated a lot of that, and he brought something new into that new Star Trek Discovery series, TV series. He's created an original gay character who will personify a lot of the issues that a 23rd century gay person might be confronted with, or some of the special powers that a gay sensibility would bring to improving a society in the 23rd century. So I think with the Star Trek Discovery series, an exciting new Gene Roddenberry-esque quality might be found there. I'm looking forward to it.
Now, George, do you think that we'll still have to be worrying about LGBT equality in the 23rd century, that you would need to kind of touch upon that? I mean, that's kind of a terrible outlook for all the work that you've been doing in LGBT advocacy.
Well, we've been making progress. You know, just last year, the Supreme Court of the United States ruled for marriage equality throughout the land. However, we're still getting resistance to it in various form.
Now, George, let me ask you this. We'll get a little hypothetical here. Earlier this year, you spoke at the Kennedy Space Center with Buzz Aldrin, who is on a mission to get humans on Mars, and folks like Elon Musk want to colonize the planet. How can,
yes.
if we're to colonize Mars, we can start from scratch here as a society. How do you protect the equality of each and every person that's going to be in a new world and in a new society?
You know, that's the tantalizing thing, isn't it? First of all, there was a time when it was an incredible thing, unbelievable thing, that we might reach Mars. And now we have our surrogate,
Curiosity?
Curiosity, mm-hmm. On Mars. And the next challenge is to get a human being there, and then the next challenge is, how is that human being going to survive? Elon Musk has said that he wants to die on Mars, and I'm sure that, you know, it, right now, from our vantage point, it seems like if he does reach Mars, he'll get his wish very quickly. But we imagined that. We imagined a colony up there. And I do think that what we imagine will eventually be made real by the scientists, the innovator, the inventors, and by trial and error, eventually get there and realize that. Right now, it's all pure science fiction. I mean, we've had movies on it. We've had the books on it. And it's tantalizing. But, you know, we're at that point in our civilization, on the planetary civilization, that's not too different from what Europe was like at the time that Columbus sailed. London was an overcrowded, crime-ridden, polluted, diseased place. And we had to find something to open up, you know, new frontiers, and to spread that population someplace else. And lo and behold, the new world that was discovered proved to be that spigot. My ancestors, my grandparents, came. They traveled east across the Pacific and came here, and Europeans traveled west and came here, and we founded this nation called the United States. We reflect the population of America today reflect the diversity of the world. We are probably the most diverse nation in the world. People from all over, and despite all the frictions that we have in this diverse cultural, ethnic, and very opinionated society, we are managing to create a nation out of that. And so I think maybe the idea, we our big cities now are like London or Paris was back in those days, overcrowded, lots of homeless people, sick people, disabled people, and there's a need to get some kind of release, and perhaps that kind of new discovery might be the way to get our civilization here on Earth an opportunity to breathe and spread out and find some way of dealing with that new reality of the challenges of colonizing another planet.
Now, George, if you continue to collect birthdays, as you say you plan on doing, can you see yourself getting a condo on Mars in the future?
I intend to celebrate my collection right here on the planet Earth. I did experience a gravity-less flight, and
yes,
it was a sensational but very disorienting feeling. It's a parabolic route that the plane follows, and so as it's going up, we have to lie down on this matted floor, and you feel gravity or the pressure of gravity crushing down on you, and so you lie down, and it becomes this heavy weight that you're experiencing, and suddenly my legs were flying up, and I thought, oh, wow. And then when I was looking at my legs going up, my arms were going up too. And so the initial adjustment to weightlessness is disorientation. I can't control myself, mm-hmm. You know. Things are happening to my limbs. And then you get a sense of experiencing weightlessness, and you kind of, with a little muscular push with your legs, go floating up and going, and some people were doing somersaults in space. It's a new sensation, and it was, once you get adjusted to it, it was a fantastic, on the level of fantasy sensation, to be absolutely gravity-less. But that lasts only for about 2 minutes, and then it starts to go down again, and you quickly have to lie down because it's... the gravity coming right back at you again. It's the adjustment is going to be both fun but also challenging.
So you'll stick to acting as an astronaut as opposed to being an actual astronaut then?
Well, actually, acting as an astronaut, we do it much, much more aesthetically. You know, when Star Trek was canceled in 1969, we thought, well, that was a great experience, and it was a lot of fun, and we're proud of what we did, but we're going to go on with our careers. But that very same year, Buzz Aldrin and Neil Armstrong landed on the moon, and we saw that on TV, and that looked so awkward and old-fashioned, that gawky vehicle that they landed on, you know. We just sparkled and beamed down on the planet. So we did it much more gracefully.
Well, George Takei, thank you so much for making the time. This was truly an honor and a pleasure to speak with you.
Well, thank you very much.
Well, that's going to do it for this episode. Support for Are We There Yet comes from the listeners of WMFE. You can follow the show online. We're on Twitter at AWTYMars. Are We There Yet, Mars? Get it? Or reach out to me in the Twitterverse. I'm at SpaceBrendan. You can also send us an email with some story ideas or interviews you'd like to hear. That's arewethereyet@wmfe.org. And leave us a review on iTunes. That's how more people find out about this podcast. Are We There Yet is a production of WMFE. Our theme music was composed by Kevin McLeod. I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.